But welcome back, everybody, to Story, Symbol, Spirit, a podcast on how to make sense of scripture. My name is John McCambridge, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host.
I'm Jackie Mitchell.
Jackie, how are you today?
Doing great. How are
doing
you?
Doing good. Yeah, doing well. I was filming a video that we were supposed to send to, put on Instagram to invite people to our Monday prayer nights. And I kept introducing myself as John McCambridge. And Jared kept being like, can you just say John? I don't know why he wanted me to just say John. But I couldn't do it because of this podcast. Sometimes when I speak, even on Sundays or whatever, I want to, like when the lights come on, I want to say,
Welcome back, everybody,
to Story, Symbol, Spirit. Which if I said that, you would have to then walk and stand beside me.
I'm Jackie Mitchell. I'd be playing in the background. I'm Jackie Mitchell.
To give you a microphone or whatever. Well, Jackie, we are on episode 65.
Yeah.
So we're only 10 episodes away from my big, celebration, which you should probably already be planning. I'm assuming that you are.
Yeah, I'm bracing, I'll say.
Bracing. And so we're going to finish up Genesis 41 today.
Uh-huh.
So what we're going to get into today is, you know, as they start to talk about what happens with the famine, before we get into Joseph having to reconcile with his brothers, which is what happens next chapters following, right now, we start to see some like very, very clear messianic foreshadowings, right? And so basically what I'm going to argue at the end of this is that Jesus is the fulfillment of Joseph, which is kind of interesting because what we're going to see as we go forward in this chapter is that the line actually ends up going through Judah, not Joseph, right? But what happens with Joseph here, who is one of the offspring of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is he starts to do things that you will see Jesus do on a grander scale, right? Which is pretty cool. And so we're going to get into that. Now, I think that in order for that to, because a lot of the commentary on this is going to be somewhat short because we only have 16 verses to get through today. So maybe we could start the discussion by just talking a little bit about why, you know, this long narrative structure of the Bible that leads to Jesus, where you kind of have to go back into the Old Testament, make all these connections, see the way that the concentric circles keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it's fulfilled in Christ. Why do you think that that is the kind of thing that God gave us, rather than like, he could have just said what was going to happen.
Could have been a pretty short book in general.
But it's not
one book.
A short
it's
book.
Like 66. Yeah.
And he could have said it all at one time.
Yeah.
But he did it over thousands of years.
Yeah.
So what do you think is going on with that? Like, what is that? Let's just take the good faith position that God's a good communicator. He wants to reveal himself to us. So why this?
A couple things come to mind. One we've talked about as a staff before, that really if you introduce yourself to someone, you never just tell them what you're made out of, or like,
even really just like,
I'm, you know, no one would say like, tell me a little bit about yourself. And you're like, well, I'm 6 foot, you know, two, and I'm, you know, just list off like all your like stats.
My
blood my blood pressure is like 118 over 80. Like, you
I have
know.
Both my ears.
Yeah. Yeah.
All 10 fingers.
Both nostrils. And you would never do that. You tell more or less a story about yourself, where you are from, who you're connected to, right? We're very relational beings. So everything about us that matters is mostly in relation to like what our story is, how we connect to other people's stories. So that's true of us. I would also say that to me, this is almost more validating or more... I want to believe it more, and it makes more sense that it is spanning such a long period of time, first of all. And then also that, like, if we were given a book that was just like, I'm God, do this, it almost is like so much more real to me because I've followed God and the story of who he is throughout, you know, a grander narrative.
Yeah.
It's like you get to know him
and
his story, which is exactly how he's chosen to reveal himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's great. And with all that, the story that he gives us is the story that he wants to give us, which when you tell someone about yourself, you give them what you think they need to know.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't give them an exhaustive history of your life.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Like when I was 1 day old.
Tell me about yourself. Well, the first day I was born.
And so a lot of times when people challenge historicity of the Bible and stuff, they just kind of assume that it should be a tape recording of all of history.
Yeah, which is not how, like, it's any... Like,
nobody ever communicates like that. Yeah. Nor would you don't even read this.
Yeah, exactly.
Let alone if God actually...
Yeah, let alone if there were more genealogies
more measurements facts and measurements and material, right? And so, yeah, I think that that's kind of an important thing where, you know, it is a history of God and creation in the way that we would tell the history of our lives, right? With that kind of emphasis and deciding what needs to be known. Because there are certain events in your life, Jackie, that someone wouldn't, you wouldn't feel like they actually know who you are if you left those out.
Correct, right? Yeah. But then there are others that, like, maybe it matters to, like, a group of friends, but otherwise, like, it's like an inside joke. Like, you need to share it with everyone, right? Yeah.
When I was 16, I told this joke to my brother. And it's like, no one cares.
It's like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah. Was that funny? He's like, yeah, I thought it was funny.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
Not important to who you are, right?
No, but that's a good point because we've been talking a lot about how, like, we have to assume, because this is true of God today, that God is working in other ways that, like, we don't see.
Right.
There are people who pop up so far in the narrative that we don't know where they come from.
Right.
We don't know where they go.
Right.
And they're like, followers of God.
Yeah.
And so we have to assume that he's working in other places that the Bible doesn't tell the story. But that's not to say that those stories don't happen.
Yeah.
It's like if a tree falls in the forest.
Yeah.
And no one's around to hear it. Like, God's still moving.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, you know, the thing, the way that God is moving in your life right now is not being recorded in,
it's not in the Bible.
Right?
And it's still, yeah, I'm still experiencing it and it's real. Yeah.
And the way that you know that it's him is because it's consistent with what,
with how he moves in scripture.
With what he's revealed in scripture, which I think is important. What was and then the second thing that you mentioned just in terms of, like, story is like sometimes lists of rules or facts, they're not helpful because we don't experience the world as a list of facts.
And our question to every list of rules or facts. Every rule you're given ever, what's your question?
Why?
Well, why? Yeah.
Or why not?
Yeah, why not? Why can't I do that?
Yeah.
This is like, here's why not. Right. These are great examples of here's why not.
Right.
To forsake your brother, you know, create idols. And, you know, there's so many examples.
As we get into Exodus, there will be moments where he begins to give them the law as you and I think of the law, which is rules, right? So you think about the Ten Commandments. But all of those commandments, and then even when we get into Leviticus, the entire Levitical revelation of how to live and how to worship and all that stuff, it's all backed up by the story, right? It isn't just a list that he gives them and says, do this, and it's not even that he just says, trust me.
Yeah.
He gives it to them, and all of that's in concert and connected to how he's already moved, and then how he will move throughout the rest of the Bible, right? Yeah. And that to me is kind of something that we all have to just be honest with ourselves, and we have to realize that we don't engage the world as a list of anything, nor do we respect lists that have nothing behind it.
Correct, yeah.
And so a lot of times people are asking, N.T. Wright has this thing where he says, sometimes the way we treat the Bible is like we think God should have given us a different kind of book. And mostly what I think, you know, in my experience, what he means by that is that the questions that we have are questions as if God should have given us a book that we wouldn't actually want if he gave it to us.
Yeah.
Because we're like, why doesn't he just tell us? And it's like, well, does that ever work?
Yeah. He does very clearly in Leviticus,
right.
Deuteronomy.
Right.
And it still didn't work, right?
And it doesn't work. Yeah. And we don't want that. And that's not...
Yeah.
Some of it would be unintelligible to us, right?
Correct. Because
it would be like, okay, here's how you're supposed to act in these relationships. Well, with no stories that back that up,
correct,
that show that
good
and bad, because a lot of the narrative of the Bible, as we've already seen, is people messing up.
Yeah, most of it is the bad examples. Yeah.
And imperfections.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that you can show the nuance of something like rules in our reality is by showing a story where people kind of do it and kind of mess it up, right? And so, you know, we're gonna get into a story about Judah, where he's the one who sold Joseph into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
It was his idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like the chief sinner right now in this story. One of the ways that he's gonna redeem himself is that he's going to tell Joseph that he's not going to leave his little brother Benjamin with him. And so Joseph, who they don't know is his brother when we get there yet, Joseph says, leave the boy. Mm-hmm. And Judah's, you know, Jacob had said, if I lose Benjamin, the other son of Rachel, life is not worth living. And so Judah tells Joseph, which we're going to see today, the most powerful man in the world, basically, you can take me or you can kill me, but you can't have him.
Mm.
And that sacrificial movement of Judah is, in my opinion, and we'll get to this, what I think puts Judah in the line leads to Joseph, right? That leads to Jesus. And, but that wasn't, it's not a story of someone who had a rule and just did it. It's a story of someone who profoundly messed up.
Yeah.
Profound sin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet through a life of, you know, dynamic change comes to a place where he starts to actually move in the right way with God. And mm-hmm. so so his life changes and his destiny changes, and that's life, right? Yeah. But that you can only ever see that through story, narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, in my opinion, God has given us what he's given us.
Yeah.
And all of the things that we're going to talk about today in terms of how Joseph foreshadows Jesus, yes, he does. And that can only be shown in story. But then also there's going to be all the rest of the Old Testament that kind of elaborates and builds upon this picture mm-hmm. of the Messiah that then once Jesus comes to pass, we can kind of put it all together.
Yeah.
And so that's what I would call the authority of the story of Scripture,
mm-hmm.
right? The Bible is authoritative for all kinds of reasons, but the story itself, not just the words, not just the truth that you pull out of the words.
Yeah, that's good.
But the storyline is authoritative.
That's good, because I do think we do also ascribe only the commandments or only the do this, don't do this in, you know, Jesus's teachings mm-hmm. or maybe Paul's writings.
Right,
as like, okay, those things I should do. The whole Bible is, what's the verse? All Scripture is all useful scripture. For teaching, right?
Yep, yep.
I can't think of
what for teaching and training and correction. And so that's why some of this is important. And that's why you would do something crazy like take, you know, 70 weeks to go through Genesis on a podcast or something, right? Because we want to really outline the story.
Yeah.
And the other parts of it too, but the story specifically is very important. And so we'll finish up Genesis 41 this week. And like I said, moving from here, it should be a pretty brief episode, but I think we should probably recap mm-hmm. so that we just remember where we are. So 2 years ago, in terms of the story, Joseph interprets the dreams of the cupbearer and the chief baker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everything that he predicts comes to pass. And so the baker was impaled, killed, mm-hmm. and his head was lifted off.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said. And the cupbearer was restored to his position with Pharaoh. And so Joseph asked the cupbearer to remember him when he gets restored, but he did not remember Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
He forgot him.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that story ends. And so last chapter, Pharaoh has some strange dreams. And what's the synopsis of these dreams?
Yeah, he sees some nice, kind of healthy-looking cows come up out of the Nile, but then they get eaten by these ugly, starving cows.
Yeah.
And then he has another very similar but separate dream where healthy stalks of wheat are eaten by stalks of wheat that are scorched by the sun.
Mm-hmm. He's agitated, he's troubled by these dreams, and no one can interpret them.
Yeah.
None of the magicians or diviners or wise men can give him any counsel or tell him what these dreams mean. And why do we say we thought that was?
We said maybe they do have an inclination as to what these could mean, but he doesn't want... Who wants to tell Pharaoh, like, hey, we're pretty sure your empire is going to fall in 7 years and there's going to be strife. And it's kind of like your fault.
Yeah. And so they conveniently can't do it. But all of a sudden, the cupbearer remembers Joseph.
Yeah.
Right? He's like, oh, actually... There might be a guy who can interpret this dream that we're all afraid you might kill us for. His name's Joseph. And so Joseph comes to him, and then Joseph drops a bar.
A crazy bar. One of the best so far, I think. I can't tell you what those dreams mean, but God can. Like dramatic pause, turn.
And so he tells him that it's 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years mm-hmm. of famine. Yeah. And so this is, like you were talking about before, being Pharaoh's fault. This is a big deal because Pharaoh is the embodied sun god.
Mm-hmm.
So Ra, the sun god, is the chief god of Egypt. And so prosperity, health, and all that rests on the shoulders of Pharaoh.
Mm.
And his job is to keep the order that leads to abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does this through rule and ritual. A lot of times when people think of ancient kings, they kind of have this idea of people who are really powerful, and because they're powerful, they get to enjoy.
They just sit around, do whatever.
The fruit of being powerful and king. But for a priest king in the ancient worldview like this, their entire life is dedicated to ritual.
Mm.
It is not a fun life. It is something where you give up everything for ritual. And even the stuff that you see in terms of like harems and sex with, that's all ritualistic, right? Like that's not just like pleasure and like, oh, I can have a bunch of harem, I can have a huge harem of women. It's all ritual. It's all has to do with the temple. It all has to do with sacrifice. It all has to do with ritual. And that's because those rituals in the ancient worldview is what leads to the order that you desire coming to pass.
Like they thought, if I don't appease the gods, if I don't continue to do this, fulfill my purpose and what I think is upholding, you know, my society, everything's done for.
Everything falls apart. Yeah. Because I'm the embodied sun god.
Yeah. So if that's true of Pharaoh, you know, then everything falls apart when things are no longer good in Egypt, right?
He's not doing
his job. It's really his fault. Yeah.
Yep. And so Joseph comes and tells him exactly what the dream is.
Yeah.
Like we said, very unafraid. And so he tells him that there's going to be famine in 7 years, but there'll be 7 years of abundance. And so we said last time that Joseph fulfills the role of the magicians, the diviners, by interpreting the dreams. And then he gives Pharaoh counsel as the wise man. And what does he give him counsel? What's he say he should do?
He says to take a fifth of the grain every year during the harvests of abundance and store it away for when the famine comes. So kind of like prepping.
Yeah. So not only might lives be saved because of Joseph, which we talked about as the blessing of the Gentiles, but Pharaoh himself might be converted to worshiping Yahweh.
Yeah.
Like if this works, then that's a really important thing. So Pharaoh is so pleased with Joseph's interpretation and his counsel that he promotes him to the number two position in all of Egypt.
Yeah.
Only behind him. So Joseph comes from prison after Potiphar's wife accuses him to the number two person in all in the most powerful empire at that time.
Yeah.
Right, in the known world.
This is like the third time we've seen him get into an absolute crazy position and just walk out like even better for it. It's kind of crazy.
I know.
It's because of God.
Yep. It's because of God. And because of that, there is the option that at least in terms of the way we would talk about conversion in this worldview, Pharaoh and therefore Egypt might be converted to worshiping Yahweh, right? There's this possibility out there because at least putting Yahweh as the God of all creation, right? So we'll have to see how that works out. But the beginning, so the beginning here, 41 through 43, is kind of repetitive to what we read last time, but we'll just read that and then we'll go on from there.
So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and people shouted before him, make way. Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt.
So in no uncertain terms, and I would say in repeated and emphasized terms, Joseph is put in charge of all the land.
Yeah.
Right, we already said that.
Yeah, but now we get a look at like his garb.
Yeah. Which is important, right? And so Pharaoh puts a signet ring on his finger. Pharaoh puts his signet ring on his finger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like in our terms today, you talk about power of attorney. If you have power of attorney over somebody, you control their life or you can. And so the signet ring is Pharaoh's, you know, that's like a symbol of his power and authority.
Isn't it also, didn't we talk about this with Judah? Is this very similar to what he gave?
Yeah, exactly.
What he thought was a prostitute.
Right.
Which was foolish because we said it was basically like giving your social security card to someone, right? It's like, I approve or disapprove of whatever. I can use this to speak on behalf of Pharaoh now.
Right, exactly. And so when Joseph says to do something, he's saying that with the full weight and authority of Pharaoh.
Flash the ring.
You got the ring,
The ring.
It's like when an FBI agent comes in and shows you his
badge,
right?
Yeah, it's the credentials. Like,
it's the credentials. And so Pharaoh, although he's not actually the sun god, he's some kind of embodied manifestation of the sun god, right? So the power that is behind the sun is embodied in the sun. So you look up there, you look at the sun. That is the sun god. It's also embodied in the ruler of Egypt, right? Mm. So Pharaoh is not the chief god, but in the Egyptian worldview, he represents the chief god in a real way, in a manifest way. And so this is like, I'm not trying to stretch this interpretation too far, but like Pharaoh is the one for Egypt.
Yeah.
He's like the father, right? And so who gets put at his right hand?
Joseph.
Joseph gets put at the right hand of the chief god, the right hand of the father, right? And so metaphorically, right? And we've been saying that Joseph is a type or a foreshadowing of Jesus. Mm. And when Jesus fulfills the covenant, he dies, he raises from the dead, and he ascends to heaven. What happens to him?
He sits at the right hand of the Father.
Sits at the right hand of the Father. And when Jesus is, before he ascends, he gives his great commission. And how does the great commission begin?
Mm. All authority on heaven and earth have been given to me.
Right. So what just happened to Joseph?
All authority, given to him, at least on earth.
From Pharaoh, right? Yeah. From the chief god of this nation. So in a symbolic sense, this I believe is what his come up is indicating, or what it's pointing to. This, you know, this is what it's going to look like. And so they also, you mentioned his garb, right? Mm-hmm. They give him royal garments. Why is that important in terms of the story?
Well, his brother stripped him of what we said kind of indicated like a royal priestly garment.
Yeah.
So now he gets it back.
So he gets it back, and then he rides on a chariot that indicates the power of the king. And so most likely he rode into Egypt naked and in a cage. And now he sits at the right hand of Pharaoh with the royal garb and with the signet ring on a chariot power.
Just such a crazy story.
And so this is the great reversal.
Oh, yeah. It's so good.
And so now he sits in charge of the entire land. Let's do 44 through 46.
Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift a hand or foot in all of Egypt. Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt.
I didn't tell you that name was in there because I wanted to see how you would do. You're pretty good.
Okay.
That was good. That was a good job.
Well, you do the better interpretation.
I don't know. I don't know. Because this is Egyptian.
Well, this is Egyptian,
so.
Yeah.
So he gives him the name Zaphnath-Paneah. And so my understanding is that these words are somewhat mysterious, but most think that it means something along the lines of God speaks and God lives. Or, and God spoke, he will live. Which makes sense, right? Because God speaks through Joseph, dream interpretation.
And people live,
and Joseph lives.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Right? Joseph comes back from the dead. I mean, there is something about prison where if you think about putting someone in the ground, putting someone in a prison, which is a structure made of the materials of ground, they're kind of in that moment, right? They're nearing death. And so he comes back from the dead, which I would say is somewhat of a foreshadowing of resurrection, which is not the first foreshadowing of resurrection we've seen, but I think it's a pretty clear one. And then he gives him the Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, who's a priest of On, to be his wife. So On is the city that the Greeks will call Heliopolis in Egypt, which is the city of the sun, right? Helio means sun, and so Polis means city, so Heliopolis is the city of the sun. And Ra, at the end of the name, Potipharah, is the sun god. And so another, you know, pagan, another pagan priest of a pagan god is given over to the son of Yahweh, who in this story is Joseph. And is, you know, as a wife, is put into Joseph's family, not the other way around, right? And so what we'll see later is that the people of God are not to intermarry with pagans, but that is because of the temptation to give up Yahweh worship.
Yeah.
And God knows his people. And so he's going to be like, I don't know if you guys remember, but as soon as Moses went up the mountain, you guys all started to do pagan things.
Immediately.
And so so don't marry pagan women.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me like you'll probably start worshiping their gods, right? But there are stories in the Old Testament, including after the law is given, that says don't do that, where when these foreign women convert to worship Yahweh. Well, now they're in the family.
Yeah.
They're no longer foreign. And so now marrying them is fine. And so that seems to be what's happening here, right? We kind of see this movement of these Egyptians, both Pharaoh, who's a king, and then the daughter of this priest are coming into the family of Yahweh. And so, Joseph is 30 years old. And so this is the age when priests take up their full responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trained until they're 30. And you see this with Jesus as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus is baptized, and his ministry officially begins when he's 30.
Mm-hmm.
So here's another foreshadowing of that with Joseph. And then it says that he goes through the whole land of Egypt, or he goes over the land of Egypt, which is a sign of dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Joseph has that because Pharaoh has given it to him.
Mm.
And so let's do 47 through 49.
During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain like the sands of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure.
So the years of plenty and abundance are here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is neither here nor there, but the land produced plentifully is actually the land produced in handfuls.
Mm.
This is what the Hebrew idiom is. And so Joseph executes the plan that he outlined earlier, mm-hmm. right, that made Pharaoh so happy. And so the language is very important here. It says that food grows like the sand of the sea. What does that language remind you of?
The abundance of the children promised Abraham.
Yeah. So let's see what happens next. Talk about children, right?
Mm.
So 50 to 52.
Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh, and he said, "It is because God has made me forget all of my trouble and all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering."
Yeah. So Joseph has children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tim Mackey always says nothing in the Bible is unintentional. So the grain was produced like sands of the sea.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, oh, that kind of reminds me of the covenant. But the covenant was about children. This is about food. And then all
immediately
of a sudden,
after
right, talks about his children. And so Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh or Manasseh is the Hebrew. It's he who brings about forgetfulness.
Mm.
And so this probably indicates Joseph's new station in life, right? Mm-hmm. He's kind of had a rough go of things.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he keeps being successful, but like success as a slave, success as a prisoner.
Yeah.
Not what you and I would consider
not
success.
The path I would want to take to success.
Yeah.
If I was able to choose. Right.
Right? Betrayed by his brothers.
Yeah.
Attempted murder.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
It's like he's doing well given the circumstances, but he didn't like those circumstances.
Yeah. So he names his son Manasseh, he who brings about forgetfulness, because it seems like at this moment he's going to be able to forget the trouble that had come upon him for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so he doesn't know this yet, but he's actually going to have to dive back into that old life and deal with all his brothers and all that soon.
Yeah.
But in this
foreshadowing,
moment,
he who forgets to forget my family before whatever.
Yeah.
I'm good. And then his family show up.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then the other son is named Ephraim, which I think means double fruitfulness. So remember we said that im at the end usually means two. And so Ephraim, this points to the fruitfulness of the line of Abraham, the promised future fruitfulness, the fruitfulness of the land that his family will one day inhabit, and probably the fruitfulness of the grain harvest that they're seeing right now. And God has given him all of that in the midst of his suffering, right? Which is what Joseph says there at the end. So these two sons will be the names that are attached to the tribes once they get into the promised land. So we'll go over that when we get there, but this is kind of tricky. All the sons of Jacob have a piece of land, except Joseph doesn't. He has two pieces of land, but the two pieces of land are named after his children.
Mm.
Right, so there will be a tribe of Manasseh, and there will be a tribe of Ephraim. And so those two names will become important. And those two names of the sons, the meaning of them indicate, you know, one of them indicates the past, which is forgotten. And then the other one indicates the future, which is the fruitfulness that, that will be given. And both are blessings from God, which is why Joseph names his kids that. And so 53 through 57, we'll wrap it up.
The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There's a famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt, there was food. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried out to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph and do what he tells you." When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe everywhere.
Mm. So the famine comes upon them, and it comes upon the entire known world, right? The known world to them. And Egypt is the only place that has food because of Joseph's plan. So one of the things that this indicates is that Joseph's dominion is not just in Egypt, it's over all the nations.
Yeah.
Because they all need him to bless them.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, this is a foreshadowing of Jesus.
Absolutely.
All the nations, everyone in the world needs the chosen one of God to bless them.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we have a foreshadowing. When Jesus ascends to heaven, he's over all of the earth. He's at the right hand of the Father. And when you think about like communion or the Lord's Supper, what does he provide all of the earth with?
Bread and...
Bread and wine.
Bread and wine, right? Yeah.
Which is what they're coming to Joseph for.
Yeah, that's true.
So honestly, like these connections are so, to me, like once you see it, it's very, very clear and intentional. And Jesus is connected to Joseph way more than we usually think.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even more connections. The Egyptians come to Pharaoh, and what does Pharaoh say?
Go to Joseph and do whatever he tells you.
Do whatever he tells you.
Yeah.
Right? There's a very important, what's the first miracle in John? In the book of John.
Jesus turns water into wine at a party, really, at a wedding.
At a wedding.
Yeah.
In Cana. And so they come to Mary and they say, "We're running out of wine."
Mm-hmm.
And Mary goes to Jesus,
mm-hmm.
her son. And Jesus says, "If it's not my time yet, why are you bothering me?"
Yeah.
And then Mary goes back to the servants. And what does she tell the servants?
Do whatever he tells you. Yeah.
And so what does Pharaoh say here about Joseph?
Do whatever Joseph says.
Do whatever he says, right? And so again, like I actually think that that line from Mary is an exact quotation of Joseph, where Joseph is the one who's blessing the world.
Mm.
Mary's the mother of Jesus. Her initial, the first time she describes him to somebody else, she quotes this line, do whatever he says. And so I really do think that that's like a direct quotation. And that's because Jesus is direct fulfillment of Joseph. I mean, look at what Joseph is doing. He's the chosen one. He holds the power of Yahweh. And that's what you see with Joseph here, at least in an unfulfilled way. And so the chapter ends with Joseph ascending all the way to the right hand of Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, actually over Pharaoh.
Yeah, really.
People come to Pharaoh.
In the story, kind of like sat back.
And Pharaoh's like, "I don't know. Ask him.
I don't know. Ask that guy. He's really in charge.
Yeah,
he's got my ring.
Yeah, my signet ring. I have to do these rituals in the Nile River. Go talk to him about getting your grain, right? And so not just over Egypt, but over all the world, over all the nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is a messianic story.
For sure.
And there is, even in the world of Christian scholarship, there's debates about how you should read the Old Testament, whether you should read Jesus back into it. Now, this is somewhat of a modern debate because if you ever read the Church Fathers, that's like the only thing they did.
Yeah.
Like they would just
read Jesus back into it.
Everything,
call it a day.
Like every moment. But you know, as we've kind of gone through like critical scholarship, and I think a lot of it is like with respect to the Jewish faith and the Jewish religion and how to, you know, interact with that. You know, there's questions of how messianic should you try to draw some of these connections. And a story like this, and not just this story, we've already been through some, but a story like this, it's just really hard for me to understand how you would read it any other way.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the one that people usually talk about is the servant songs in Isaiah, where it's like, how do you not read that as what happened to Jesus, right? Like, can we just be honest for a second? But this story, I think, is almost as clear.
Yeah,
where for sure. All these connections to Jesus, even what I would argue is almost a direct quotation that Mary uses that's, you know, connected to what Pharaoh says mm-hmm. of Joseph. It's not coincidence, and it's mm-hmm. not happenstance. And there is something called, in biblical scholarship, called interpretive maximalism, where you just try to draw every connection you can think of. Mm. And that's actually what James Jordan is accused of most of the time from people. Mm. And he's one of my favorites. And he always points something out to me that I'd never seen before. And so a lot of the things I bring to this podcast are from him and his exegesis of the text. And there's definitely things that I read from him sometimes that I think, like, maybe that's a little bit too much. Mm. But really, I think he just kind of reads with the level of detail that the church fathers read with.
For sure.
And we're not used to that.
No.
And so it seems like you're trying to do something when you make all these connections, right? And because we don't always look at people in good faith, we're kind of like, why are you trying so hard to make that connect to this? And part of the way that I look at the Bible is like, because it probably does.
Yeah.
And it might be subtle. And sometimes it's subtle. This is not subtle to me. Mm. The story of mm-hmm. Joseph is like, give me a picture of Jesus in the Old Testament. Like, one of the things I would bring up is like, read the story of Joseph going to Egypt.
For sure.
Right. I find that to be very clear. And that is part of what we began this episode with in terms of like the story and the narrative mm-hmm. and the long drawn out structure of it. Because Moses is going to be a Jesus-like figure.
Yeah.
Joshua is going to be a Jesus-like figure. Mm-hmm. David's going to be a Jesus-like figure. Actually, before David, Samuel is going to have messianic implications in what he's doing. And then David, and then honestly, some of the good kings of Judah, which are few and far between, but they're going to do things that you start to see when they come back from the exile, like Zerubbabel and some of mm-hmm. these guys, like there's some connections. And then the prophets, right? You read Isaiah, there's so many of these clear connections to what he's saying. Certainly Jeremiah, even some of the minor prophets, like Jonah, mm-hmm. right, which we already talked about, some of what Jonah is doing. And so basically God has given us this just incredibly long, drawn out story where at every moment something seems to be pointing to what's going to happen mm-hmm. in Jesus. And it makes me laugh because I think the reason God does that is because it's like he's over-explaining for us.
Yeah.
And yet we look at it and we're kind of like, we look at the over-explanation and we're like, I think we're reaching too far with that one, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really know if that connects to Jesus. Mm. But I think that it probably does connect to Jesus because that's exactly what God's trying to do.
I'd say probably everything connects to Jesus in some way.
Yeah, and especially like in terms of fulfillment.
Yeah,
for right? sure. When Jesus says that he came to fulfill the law, that doesn't just mean Leviticus. Mm-hmm. The law is the Torah, mm-hmm. which is the first five books of the Bible. So Jesus is saying, I came to fulfill the first five books of the Bible when he says that,
the
right?
The fulfillment of all of these characters.
Yeah. And then at one point he says something about, you know, all the law and the prophets hang on this word that I give to you. Well, the law and the prophets was the whole Bible at that time, right? The whole Hebrew scriptures. And so it is important to understand that Jesus's life and the event of Christ and the effect of Christ is the fulfillment mm-hmm. of all these things that we see, not just the laws and the commands, but the whole story mm-hmm. and these little examples that seem to be messianic in these stories, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Joseph so far and what we've read is the clearest example of that.
Yeah.
And definitely. So it's some of the clearest connections to Jesus. And I think it's okay to read the Bible like that. In fact, I think you have to. Mm. I think you have to read the Bible like that as a Christian, at least. And so next week, we are reintroduced to the brothers.
Yeah.
So here's poor Joseph. He names a son about being able to forget his past, Manasseh.
Here come the brothers and now rolling the brothers up and asking back. For stuff too. They're hungry.
Yeah, and that's another thing that they're doing here when it keeps saying that all the land came to Egypt, right? Is it's setting up
there
the
was
fact
a famine that everywhere.
That includes his brothers, and so they're gonna come.
They're coming.
To Egypt, and so we'll have to see how that goes. But anything else, Jackie?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Story Summer Spirit.